Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Many experts think that when the COVID-19 pandemic recedes, that we'll still have variants of the novel coronavirus with us for years to come. In that scenario, with vaccines more abundant and some treatments available, it'll no longer be the worldwide scourge that it is, but more of a seasonal inconvenience. My guest today is an expert in another set of infections which have been with us for centuries and show few signs of abating, those which are sexually transmitted. And she's written a fascinating and funny new book about the history and treatment of what used to be known as STDs, and before that, venereal diseases. Ina Park is an associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also a consultant at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the Division of STD Prevention, and medical director of the California Prevention Training Center. Her brand new book is called Strange Bedfellows: Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. In the book, Park takes us on a historical and current tour of infections like syphilis, gonorrhea, and herpes, and through humor and clear prose, she contextualizes these and other infections to help lessen their stigma and teach us how both medicine and patients cope with these afflictions. Dr. Ina Park, author of Strange Bedfellows, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Ina Park, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you teach us about terminology. So it seems like the current acronym or letters are STIs, sexually transmitted infections. But over the years, they've been called different things.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think up until about the 70s, the term VD or venereal disease was sort of in vogue. And I think the issue with that term is that the word venereal implies that there's some sort of venery or promiscuous sex outside of a relationship is going on. And, you know, the truth is that these just happen to be infections that could be transmitted in any situation, whether it be between two people who are stably coupled or someone who is single and out on the prowl. And so, you know, after the 70s, the term sexually transmitted disease came into vogue because that was sort of thought to be more clinically accurate. But then there was a recognition that there's about, you know, 36 different types of infections, bacteria, and viruses that can be sexually transmitted. And some of them, like the human papillomavirus or HPV, most of the time don't actually cause any disease. And so some people felt like, well, maybe we ought to call them sexually transmitted infections because that's the more accurate term, because many times they don't actually cause real disease. But, you know, in my business right now, we sort of use the terms interchangeably depending on what we're talking about, because certainly some of the infections like syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia do cause true disease. And so many people are trending towards using STI because they feel like it's less stigmatizing, and I'm all for that. That's why I wrote this book to begin with. So I try to use STI as much as possible throughout the book.
Yeah, and you do a good job of explaining kind of why you use different terminology when.
Yeah.
But I, too, personally like the idea of STI because it seems less judgmental, certainly,
right,
than the phrase venereal or the word venereal, and then diseases, which that term itself is loaded.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about, I mean, right here at the outset, about parallels to COVID-19.
Sure.
Obviously, our news is sort of dominated by the pandemic. But, you know, before COVID-19 pandemic, you know, HIV is considered a worldwide pandemic, although we don't necessarily, I think, I mean, certainly in the business you're in, and I think in medicine, we think of it that way. But although it has been in the news, certainly in the 80s, 90s, it's not so much in the news now because we've developed good treatments to sort of control it.
Right.
But one of the things that we have all learned is this idea of contact tracing, right? So if someone is infected with the novel coronavirus, public health departments will go out and try to find those people with whom they've come into contact to try to stanch the spread of COVID-19. Well, that's very important in your business. And I was interested to learn that at least initially, or maybe initially you did call it that, but there was a period of time where you weren't using the term contact tracing. And I guess you went into this term of art partner notification, but I guess now everybody knows what contact tracing is. So maybe it's less fraught to use that term.
Yeah, I think, you know, contact tracing started for syphilis actually control in the 30s. And that was a term that was used for a long time. Then in the 80s, when HIV and AIDS struck, you know, a lot of health departments didn't want to do contact tracing, and a lot of communities who were affected by HIV/AIDS, you know, namely men who have sex with men, really felt like the government was snooping around and they were going to collect their names and use them somehow to, you know, label them or somehow discriminate against them. And so contact tracing really had a bad rap. And so people tried to rebrand it, so to speak, in our business and make it sound more customer service oriented. So they changed it from contact tracing, which sounds sort of like a detective snooping around in your business, to the term partner notification, which sounds more like, hey, I'm doing you a favor. I'm notifying your partners that they might have an STI. And now with COVID-19, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, everyone and their grandmother knows what contact tracing is. And so we're back to contact tracing and people have embraced that wholeheartedly now.
Yes. And I was wondering, too, I saw a recent press release from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where you're a consultant, where I guess 1 in 5 Americans are estimated to harbor a sexually transmitted infection. I mean, that's a headline grabbing press release. But what can you help parse that for us?
Absolutely. You know, that press release came out actually this week on Monday and stated, you know, based on their analysis of their surveillance data over the past 10 years or so, that currently, based on their most recent data that is complete, 1 in 5 Americans are living with some sort of STI, and that could include anything from the viral infections, which are, you know, really common, such as HSV or herpes simplex virus or HPV, human papillomavirus, and then includes all of the bacterial STIs as well that they do surveillance for, which is gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. And then there's also, you know, parasites, which we don't do surveillance on, like trichomonas, but, you know, actually there's lots of infections and they're very, very common infections. So when they put everything together and estimated, that's what they came up with. But the truth is, over a lifetime, pretty much every sexually active person is going to get exposed to at least HPV or human papillomavirus. So that 1 in 5 statistic really is a snapshot of what they think is happening in the country at the moment. But if you look at someone over their lifetime, you know, their risk of getting HPV is well over 80% at some point.
Yeah. And similarly, most adults have had exposure to herpes, whether it's herpes simplex type 1 or type 2.
Yep, absolutely.
And those used to be, and that's something that really confounds people when they hear that. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was wondering if you could try to ease some of our concerns about it.
Yes. And, you know, that brings me to sort of the point of this whole book is I just want people to understand that these infections are a normal part of being a sexually active person and that, or even just being alive in the case of, you know, HSV 1 and 2 or herpes simplex virus 1 and 2. Just from things like, you know, sharing a cup with somebody or, you know, when you're living in the same household with them, that kind of stuff happens, you can easily transmit HSV 1. So when we talk about the American public, almost everybody is going to have been exposed to one of those types of herpes viruses and often to both at some point in their life.
Yeah, and you do such a nice job with a chapter on herpes, and as you mentioned, mm-hmm. human papillomavirus, a whole chapter on that. Let me reintroduce you here, and then we can talk about some of these specific conditions. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Ina Park, who's an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also a consultant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and medical director of the California Prevention Training Center. She's the author of a wonderful brand new book called Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs, Sexually Transmitted Diseases. There was so much that I learned in this book. And I guess a place I wanted to go was to talk about syphilis, which the mere mention of it sometimes I think gives people the heebie-jeebies. But it's been with us for so long throughout history. And of course, so many famous historical figures have either been known to have suffered from syphilis or suspected to have died from complications of syphilis. Take us through whatever highlights you'd like to feature about syphilis and then how we think about it today.
Well, you know, I think when syphilis first struck, which is best described, I think, in Italy, I think it's similar in a sense to what we're dealing with right now during the COVID-19 pandemic. No one had any immunity, you know, to this bacteria. And so the way the infection sort of showed up or manifested in people was so severe and it was so devastating, they actually had to create a separate hospital system in Italy just to deal with these folks with incurable syphilis because, of course, they had no treatment back then. And over time, the severity of the infection has declined. Now we have so many antibiotics that actually have activity against syphilis and we have effective therapy with penicillin. So we rarely have somebody who's dying from complications of syphilis, but that was really commonplace when it was, you know, first sort of showed up in the 1500s. And, you know, these days it can show up in really, really subtle ways. And I have a story about a patient of mine who I saw who had just the most subtle rash in the groin area that I never would have, you know, looked at had he come in complaining of his symptoms at a primary care clinic. He just felt, you know, he felt fatigued and he had a headache. But it turned out, like, by looking, you know, at his groin, he actually had a rash from syphilis. And that's just the thing I think is a great take-home message for folks out there who are sexually active who might wonder if they're at risk for syphilis. It's very hard to know whether you have it without getting a, you know, blood test or serology test, because it can be very subtle and have no symptoms at all, or it can show up with a severe rash or headache or neurological symptoms. So it's called the great imitator, you know, in our world, because it really can look like any condition or it can look like nothing at all. You know, as you know, being a physician yourself, it's one of those things that can easily fool people unless they're thinking about it and have a high index of suspicion to test for it.
I remember back in the days of learning dermatology where we were taught, always have syphilis at the bottom of your differential, because it could always be syphilis. Any rash could always present as syphilis. And
Absolutely.
I was fascinated to learn that both the, and I'm going to get this wrong, but the American College of Dermatology or the American Board of Dermatology, at one point in the early, in the formation of those, that specialty field, they called themselves something like the College of Dermatology and Syphilis or something.
Syphilology. So syphilology, you know, syphilis is so common, it had to have its own specialty within the field of medicine, and it kind of was folded in with the dermatologists. And then, you know, some of them were just not so keen on being associated with an STI. And so essentially they divorced themselves from the field of syphilology and they just became the American Board of Dermatology. And then I say, you know, syphilis became this lone man with no country. It just stopped being a specialty. And the field of venerology, or just the study of sexually transmitted diseases, you know, still persists today. It's not its own sort of specialization that one can get boarded in, but, you know, there's folks like me and folks who are infectious disease trained as well who, you know, just have devoted their life to the study of it. It certainly is a field, but it's just not a separate medical subspecialty anymore.
Syphilology. We just have to say that one more time. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's one other point that I want to make here, because it's a good pivot point to the next topic.
Sure.
And that is that you mentioned the treatment of syphilis, which, thank goodness, we now have today, is good old penicillin.
Absolutely.
And amazingly, I mean, I've spent many episodes of this program talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria and the risk we all face when we overuse antibiotics. And for whatever reason, this strange twisted bacterium, and I do mean that twisted because that's the shape of it.
Yep.
I guess you could argue it has a metaphoric meaning as well. But Treponema pallidum, as it's known, is universally sensitive to penicillin. That is, penicillin just cures syphilis, you know, pure and simple. And for reasons I don't understand, I mean, that miracle, we should just accept that and be grateful. On the other hand, there's gonorrhea, the so-called clap, I guess, is one of its many nicknames. You have a whole chapter on how gonorrhea has become multi-drug resistant. Let's talk a little bit about that and some of the work. You mentioned a character in your book, I'll call him a character, King Holmes. Very interesting, the research and work that he's done. And I was not aware of it. Can you share some of what he's done?
Yeah, so I call King Holmes sort of the godfather of modern STI research. And, you know, he started off his career in the military. And he wasn't trying to get out of going to Vietnam, but he did ask when he was going to be drafted whether or not he might be able to go and do research at the preventive medicine unit in Hawaii. So that's where he got to spend the Vietnam War, was stationed in Honolulu. And there he started hearing about cases of incurable gonorrhea in the Pacific Islands. So what he ended up doing was going over to the Philippines and collecting specimens from folks who were sex workers there. And he had to carry them back on a plane in a tank of liquid nitrogen to keep them cold, and that, you know, that tank started smoking on the plane, and they tried to get him to dump it out, and he, you know, was holding it in between his legs the entire flight back to stateside, but then ended up testing these strains and realizing that they were resistant to penicillin, which was sort of the first time that we saw, you know, evidence of gonorrhea antibiotic resistance to an and so over time, which your listeners might not know about, is the fact that gonorrhea has developed antibiotic resistance to basically every single class of antibiotics that have been used to treat it. And we are down to one class of antibiotics left. And we have a couple that are being studied in the pipeline, but it's a race against time, as you know, to see if our arsenal of antibiotics runs out before the bacteria actually develops these super mutations and becomes incurable. Not to scare people, but that's, you know, we know that that's how antibiotic resistance works, is that, you know, we only have a limited number of antibiotics to treat anything, and so we have to be very careful with how we use them to make sure that we still have them when we need them later on.
So there were a couple of other interesting tidbits to that story. One was that when King Holmes was in the Philippines, the first problem was that, I guess, when they were trying to diagnose or get samples from the sex workers, they kept reusing some of the same equipment. So even if people weren't infected, they were basically spreading gonorrhea from patient to patient.
Exactly. And this particular nurse who was doing these exams was very efficient. So she would do, you know, 100 exams a day. So you can imagine she was very efficiently spreading the infection to all of the population of sex workers in Olongapo, which is the city that we're talking about. And so, yes, it was a simple thing, which is just, you know, he brought on the aircraft, on the aircraft carrier, he brought a autoclave machine, which sterilizes equipment, and brought them a bunch of equipment so they wouldn't have to use the same equipment on other people. So those simple interventions actually really helped control the gonorrhea in that population.
Yeah. Now I want to shift gears here and talk about another infection that's very important. And you have a whole chapter, and I have to say, you really taught me a ton about the controversy, which I just didn't even, because I'm a, you know, general internist and I see this on a very limited basis. And that is this idea of PrEP. Tell us what PrEP is and why it's controversial.
So I think a good way to think about it for folks who, you know, are not necessarily in the medical field is most everyone knows what the birth control pill is. And I would think about this as sort of a birth control pill for HIV. So it's a daily medication that someone can take. And if they take it every day and take it consistently, essentially, if they get exposed to HIV, their risk of contracting it would essentially be zero. So it's a highly, highly effective strategy if taken every day to protect someone from catching HIV through either vaginal or anal sex.
And let's remind people, PrEP stands for, is it pre-exposure prophylaxis? Is that the idea?
Yes, it's pre-exposure prophylaxis, and there are two medications combined into one pill. There's actually two different types of pills available now, Descovy and Truvada, that people can take, but they are two medications combined that someone takes daily. And then there's also this, you know, new way to take it where people can actually take it both before and after a sexual encounter. So there's what we call event-driven use, and that is not as common as folks taking it daily, but that is something that's newer that has come out just in the past few years.
Now, you would think, and I thought, that PrEP is a godsend for people at risk for HIV, and that's usually men who have sex with men, but it's also, you know, really anybody who's sexually active, and certainly, you know, people who, for example, use intravenous drugs who aren't getting clean needles.
Yep.
But it wasn't always viewed that way, say, in the gay community. So what was the issue there? What is the issue there?
You know what it was, John, is that there were some folks, and I'm going to use Larry Kramer as an example, who's one of the, you know, best-known AIDS activists of the time, who was living with HIV himself for many years and had a lot of complications related to it. And I think folks like that, who had seen so many of their friends die, just felt like people should just use condoms and not sort of use this pill as a way out to be able to have unprotected sex. I mean, to him, the idea of someone having sex without a condom was just absolutely intolerable. And, you know, he actually says, you know, don't even think about it. No way, Jose, is what he says in a speech that he gave in New York. And then some of the other folks in the field also said, you know, this is a party drug and, you know, didn't really take it seriously as a prevention intervention, but it is an incredibly effective prevention intervention that I think is going to save a lot of lives. But it has not always been controversial. And even among gay men themselves, you know, there was a journalist who actually came out and called people who took this medication Truvada, and they called them Truvada whores. So there was a lot of folks stigmatizing each other and labeling each other as, you know, quote unquote promiscuous if they were going to be taking this medication. But I'm here to tell you, you know, based on prescribing this to patients with all different types of situations in their life, that some folks who take it, you know, take it just because they want to be an extra layer of security because they have a partner who happens to be HIV positive. And some folks who are more sexually active are taking it, you know, as an insurance policy there as well and still use condoms 100% of the time. So, you know, it's definitely not an excuse for people to just go wild, I would say, which is sort of how it was framed in the beginning when it first came out.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Ina Park, who is an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, also a medical consultant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She is also the medical director of the California Prevention Training Center, and I would say an advocate and a scholar about all things sexually transmitted infections. Ina, you have such an interesting background, your biography, I guess, I learned from the book jacket, but also I should point out you have a really nice website, inapark.net. That's I-N-A, Park, how it sounds, and then .net. And you can learn more about Dr. Park there. You were a peer sex educator, I think, in college. Tell us about what that entailed.
So this is how I got into medicine. You know, I think all of us who are in medicine have some sort of event or experience where they feel called, you know, to the field. And that activity is what sort of called me to this work. And I essentially was teaching other students. I would see them, you know, after they received an STI diagnosis and counsel them about, you know, what this meant. And I would also counsel people who were considering birth control and try to talk about the pros and cons of different methods. So I spent a lot of time one-on-one with students having these conversations about really intimate topics and topics, you know, that were emotionally charged. And sometimes after a diagnosis, people were, you know, obviously very upset or concerned. So that sort of one-on-one interaction in a counseling setting really got me excited, I think, to, you know, head into the field of medicine and, you know, affect people's lives that way. But one of the other things that happened was, as part of our activities as peer educators, we had to hold the National Condom Day festivities at UC Berkeley. And so I ended up dressing up as a giant condom. The only thing you could see was my face. The rest of me was covered with this enormous condom costume. And I did this condom demonstration with a banana on the steps of Sproul Hall, where they had all the Vietnam War protests and whatnot. And I was in front of, like, you know, at least 100 people at lunchtime doing this condom demonstration. And I wrote about that as the topic for my medical school, you know, personal statement. And believe it or not, I got into medical school despite writing about that. Some people really thought that was great. And other folks, I think, thought I was a little bit crazy. But it all worked out in the end.
That's so interesting. I could see why that would be appealing to medical schools. On the other hand, I wonder if your parents even knew about that. It sounds like, from what I've read about you, they might not have been so enthusiastic about those activities.
Oh, John, they've had a long journey trying to accept this daughter of theirs who, like, you know, goes around, like, the frat houses and dorms with the, you know, plastic penises doing condom demonstrations. And I think they knew what was going on, but they chose not to discuss it because they were both very conservative. They had an arranged marriage. You know, they were both virgins on their wedding night, and they really expected me to do the same. And I think they had this daughter who, you know, was talking to people about sex and wanting to be a sex educator. And of all things, you know, my father said, why can't you become a cardiologist or a radiologist? Why do you have to study, you know, STDs? But they've gotten over it now. And now I think they accept me and they're happy for me.
Well, and you have this book out, so and I imagine interviews like this are going to help with the public engagement. And that's something else I wanted to ask you about. So you've done not only a medical degree and are a fully fledged physician, but you have a degree in public health, which is equally impressive, and have won an alumni award from your College of Public Health, I think, at the University of Minnesota. But then you engaged, well, using the word twice, you engaged in this fellowship in public engagement. Tell us what that is and how that came about.
Yeah, so the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, they actually put out, you know, the publication Science and a bunch of others as well. But they actually have a Center for Public Engagement that was started by Alan Leshner, who's one of their presidents. And they actually take 15 people from around the world every year, and they have a different topic area of focus. And they actually just teach them about, you know, what are the ways to message the public? How do you use social media? How do you write an opinion piece for publication? And they talk about how can we as scientists translate, you know, the medicine and the science in a way that people can understand, which, you know, is a lot of what you do in your work as well. But not having any sort of formal idea about how to do it, I'm sure, you know, you sort of learn as you go. But this was sort of a formal year-long process where a little bit of a public engagement boot camp, so to speak.
Was there a specific project you had to do as part of the fellowship or some kind of, you know, thesis, as it were?
It wasn't really like that. We had to do some media training, and we also, you know, I applied saying, I'm going to have a book out. I'm in the process of writing it, and I'd like to know about the different ways that I can get this message out there. And so a lot of what I learned about was, you know, which outlets to sort of go to promote the book and to talk about, you know, what are the effective ways to communicate with the media and that type of thing. So I feel better prepared for what we're doing today because of that fellowship.
Excellent. It is clearly paid off. Let's conclude kind of back where we started. The theme of condoms has come up in a number of our segments here. Yeah. And we talked about it with PrEP, that is people who are at risk for HIV using PrEP, but also choosing to continue to use condoms or not, mm-hmm. but that you dressed up as a condom. You have a whole chapter on the condom. And I guess what lessons would you hope that readers take away about sort of the simple old condom?
You know, I feel like the condom has gotten a bad rap. And one of the things I talk about is how, you know, folks, especially young people, are using condoms less and less. And I think that the condom is sort of suffering from image issues. And I think, you know, my sincere hope and one of the things that I talked about is that folks like the Gates Foundation and other funders actually tried to throw some money out there at innovators to see if they could make something that's better. Because we understand that using a condom often to people does not feel as good as having skin-to-skin contact. So there's nothing I can do about that, but I have to say, you know, using some sort of barrier, whether it be the internal condom or what they used to call the female condom, or the external condom or the male condom, you know, that's the best thing we have to protect against STIs right now. So I think that's my take-home message. But I identify with people who don't like them. I feel you. And I also just want to emphasize that I wish we had something better right now, but we don't have a lot of other options.
So if a listener to this program or a reader of your book, what do you hope, besides being what we might call sex positive, that is mm-hmm. being in a place where they can enjoy sex, consensual sex, but doing it safely, as safe, you know, as possible,
right.
Well, what would you recommend as far as someone who hearing this program saying, geez, I wonder if, you know, I've had sex partners. I wonder if I have an STD. I don't have any symptoms, but I'm now nervous about it. What would you recommend about that?
Yeah, that's one of the things. I'm really glad you asked that question, because one of the things I wanted to do with this was to have people walk away from it feeling, you know, as positive as they could about the idea of perhaps having an STI and normalizing the fact that, you know, most of us are going to get an STI at some point in our lives, even if we don't realize it. And for people to feel empowered to say, well, I might not be able to prevent myself from getting an STI, that you can't prevent it completely, but I can take charge of it and actually, you know, go get tested and take control of my health. And that's what I can control. You know, sometimes you can't control a condom breaks or, you know, you get intoxicated and you slip up and you have sex with someone you didn't mean to. I mean, those things are going to happen in life and STIs happen. But what you can do is to basically take charge and test and try to reframe it in your mind to say, hey, this happens to a lot of people, and not, you know, sort of punish yourself for having it happen to you.
Well, that's a great message to end on. The name of the book is Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Ina Park. Ina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I loved being on.
Dr. Ina Park is author of the brand new book, Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.